Greetings again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, friends, students, and allies around the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 27th of February, 2013, nav briefing number 53, entitled Going Forward in 2013. I've been promising for some time since we entered the 50 series of these briefings to cover the navigational parameters as we usually do in our procedure. That is to say, to give you a review and preview of the apogee and perigee moments and other details of celestial navigation that are pertinent to this experiment. So here I am doing this, finally getting around to it. As you know, I've been quite wrapped up in the Mephisto question, and I've had my hands full, you could say, downloading Dakini instructions from Matangi. So those concerns, if you will, those exciting matters have somewhat impeded me from directing my attention to the specifics of navigation, as I shall now do. Now, to kick off this briefing, I ask you all to take a few steps back. You're all standing around me here on the observation deck. Let's all take a few steps back, five or six steps back, and look at the entire picture of the three-year period from March 2011 to March 2014. Observe, on March 19th, when the initial conditions of correction were set in motion, the lunar perigee, the near point of the Earth, of the Moon to the Earth, stood in 1 degree of Libra. Picture that in the constellations. That is exactly in the head of the Virgin, at the forehead of the Virgin, right between the eyes. So at that particular moment, March 19th, 2011, the head of the lunar perigee was right there, right in the forehead of the Virgin. I want to answer a question, by the way, on that subject that comes from a crew member. It's a question that others among you may well have considered in your minds. This is a question from Henriette, who writes, Dear John, when Sophia started the signaling of correction, how could she do that without having restored her pronoia and enoia? Wasn't she still in this amnesic autism when she initiated the correction? Did you, by getting her attention, wake her up from her autism? In all modesty, she puts in quotes. Or did she, before her plunge, build in a failsafe in the sky, the conjunction of the North Node to the galactic center? And that's a question from crew member Henriette. Well, it certainly was not the Nawal's act of getting Gaia's attention that produced the wake-up call, as it were. How could the Aeon Sophia have signaled to the galactic center if she was in her autistic state at that time in March of 2011? And if she had not restored her pronoia, that is to say, her autonomy as an aeonic being? According to the story, when the Aeon Sophia succumbs to metamorphosis, and when her torrential currents of organic light, subject to the conditions in the galactic limb, take on elemental and material substance, she loses, to some degree, her autonomy as an aeonic being. She goes into a state of relative amnesia regarding her origins. She goes into autism, and she loses her pronoia, which is to say, her cognitive ability, the ability to conceive an action and to act directly upon that action. All of this happens simply because her awareness as an aeon comes to be totally captured in the process of planetary embodiment. And she must give her attention, the greater part of her attention, to maintaining the entire planet by the power of her dreaming. So, that is the picture presented in the sacred narrative. This would be, say, FGS, Fallen Goddess Scenario 3.0 now. We got up to 3.0. 1.0 is the 9-episode version, in not in his image. That is to say, it's just the restored version. 2.0 came about in the first few months of correction. Now we're looking at version 3.0 of the Fallen Goddess Scenario, and verging very rapidly on 4.0. In fact, you could say once we're in the correction process, involved in the process, and considering how she materializes her tulpa, we are in the Fallen Goddess Scenario 4.0. So you can see how rapidly this experiment is developing. Now, to answer Henriette's question, the Aeon Sophia sent out a call to the Galactic Center on March 19th, 2011, that may be compared to the yelp or muffled scream of someone sleeping, someone having a nightmare. You know how animals, when they dream, cats and dogs, when they dream, particularly dogs, I think, will yelp in their sleep. Likewise, a person having a nightmare and unable to wake from the nightmare will sometimes scream or emit a kind of choked sound of anguish. And this, in fact, is how the Aeon Sophia signaled to the Pleroma at that time. In the awareness of lucid dreaming of the planetary animal mother, she released a cry for help. And this cry was not at that time an articulate cry. It was simply a cry of alarm. And so she did not have to restore her pronoia to make that cry. She did not have to come out of her autism or out of her amnesia. Nevertheless, as Henriette correctly observes, the conditions for a full remembering of her origins in the Pleromic Center were ripe at that moment of time. Why is that? Well, let's go back again to March 19th, 2011, and we're going to come forward to the present moment. I'll bring you forward to the present moment, and then we'll look forward to the moment about 14 months from now. Three factors to consider in March 2011. The position of the lunar perigee between the eyes of the Virgin. That speaks for itself. The position of the lunar apogee close to what is called the vernal point, or the first degree of Aries, the first degree of the ecliptic scale of 360 degrees. So the first degree of Aries is degree 1 on the ecliptic scale. The last degree of Pisces is degree 360 on the ecliptic scale. And the line that divides those two is called the vernal point. It corresponds to the position of the sun at the spring equinox. So currently, when the sun is at that point, in passage from Pisces to Aries, it stands beneath the body of the fish or whale that is swimming westward, that is to say, horizontally along the zodiac. That is the current position, and that point, the vernal point, is the hour hand on the cosmic clock or star clock. So, calculating by a rate of 1 degree every 72 years, you can wind that point backward in time. For instance, if you wind it back to the position where it stood on the border between the constellation of the ram and the constellation of the fishes, that corresponds to the date 120 BC. So the vernal point is the hour hand of the cosmic clock, and obviously it has tremendous significance in that sense and on a number of different levels. The vernal point measures the hours of the day. Remember, 26,000 years is one day in this experiment in the mind of the Aeon, in the mind of the Aeon Sophia and the attending Aeons in the galactic center. 25,920 years is but one day. And so the vernal point is the hour hand of the clock that rotates once every day, makes a full rotation. How fantastic then that the lunar apogee at the inception of correction stood exactly in that point. So that's the second factor. What is the third factor? The third factor to look at in this wide review is the lunar nodes. Everything is about the moon, my friends. It's all about the moon, okay? It's because the moon is part of the Gaian dynamic ecosystem as well as part of the psyche of the planet Earth. The moon and the sun and the Earth are a single Gaian system. So, the third factor is the nodes of the moon, which I've introduced recently. And where do you see the north node of the moon located in March 2011? Very, very close to 27 or 28 degrees of Sagittarius, which is 268 on the ecliptic scale. And that is, of course, exactly in alignment with the galactic center. So here is your picture for March 2012. The picture of the writing, if you will, the picture of the indications in the celestial code, in the visible, observable celestial code. North node of the moon at the galactic center, apogee of the moon at the vernal point beneath the whale swimming west, and perigee of the moon in the forehead of the constellation of the Virgin Isis Sophia. These are the initial conditions in celestial terms for the inception of Sophia's correction. All right then. Now, before focusing in on the current conditions, about 13 or 14 months before the completion of this period, let's still remain in this position, stepping back a few steps to look at the big picture. And let's go and look at the conditions that pertain in the spring of 2014. Well, take first the lunar perigee, indicator of divine alchemy. On March 27th, 2014, the lunar perigee stands in 325 of the ecliptic, which is in the tail of the goldfish. What happens in the spring of that year, just a year from now, is that the lunar perigee, which, as you know, vacillates wildly, makes a steady progression into the goldfish. So on January 30th, it's at the head of the goldfish. On February 27th, it's in the arc of the goldfish. And on March 27th, it's in the tail. So it touches all three points of the goldfish. Of course, the goldfish is the image of the arc that sails through time. It is the image of continuity from one kalpa to another. It is the image of the process by which the Aeon Sophia accumulates the seeds of experience from one kalpa and sows them into the next kalpa. the seeds or potentials of experience are carried in the Ark of the Goatfish. Also, as you know, the Ark of the Goatfish is the zodiacal constellation that corresponds to Kali herself. So we say Mahakali. And she represents the power of the aeons of fire that operates around you, all around you in nature, and operates in the human psyche as well. And within the human psyche, this aspect or frequency or modality of Sophia's intelligence, called Mahakali, has the capacity to take you completely out of linear time. Now, when Kali destroys the illusion of time, she does not destroy the experience of time. No, not at all. You do not arrive in timelessness. If you want to go to timelessness, then you go to the mysterious zone of inactivity of Shiva and the mysterious zone of the originator. Do you want to go to timelessness? Nothing happens in timelessness. Everything is frozen. I was there once on Infinity Ridge. Gaia put me in timelessness for about 2 hours. Now, it's a paradoxical statement, isn't it? And I can tell you that nothing moves in timelessness. So anyway, when Kali destroys the illusion of time, of linear time, note the syntax, she confers the possibility for human awareness to realize the fractal structure of time. So that is a theme, that is a possibility connected with the image of the goatfish. So we find the lunar perigee located in that constellation upon the completion of these 3 years. All right, next. Where is the lunar apogee located at the completion of these 3 years? Well, already in January, the lunar apogee has advanced into the twins, and it is very close to the head of the twins, Castor and Pollux. Now remember that the head of the twins, those two bright stars in the constellation of Gemini, if you will, of the twins, represent the hook on the left arm of the anchor. As you're looking up at the celestial anchor, imagine that it lies at a diagonal above, to your vision. That is to say that the point of the anchor is to the left of the top of the anchor. So it lies at a diagonal. This is how it can be observed usually in the northern hemisphere. And the two arms or branches of the anchor extend to right and left. And to the left extends the part of the anchor that is that corresponds to Castor and Pollux. How wonderful is that? This was not something that I knew or preconceived in any way at the beginning of this experiment. You were all there in the first week of September 2012 when the celestial anchor appeared. It appeared spontaneously in the sky, but also interactively. It appeared in the imagination of the GNE crew, didn't it? So that was a visionary event in real time. And now, lo and behold, if you follow the progression of the celestial factors of navigation, you see that the lunar apogee reaches the twins, Castor and Pollux, and sails beyond the twins into the crab. And that is the moment that signals, more or less roughly, you don't have to pin it down to a day, but that is the moment that signals the completion of the 3 years of correction. So sometime between March 11th, when the lunar apogee stands at 28 Aries, directly at the head of the twins, and April 8th, when it has advanced into the crab, or the chambered nautilus, there you have it. At that time, by the way, Jupiter stands in the mid-body of the constellation of the twins. And there's a lot to say about that in upcoming briefings. Finally, we have to say, well, where is the, what's happening with the north nodes of the moon 13 or 14 months from now? Where do the north and south nodes of the moon stand in the visible array of the zodiacal constellations? Now, remember that the nodes of the moon are always opposite each other, not like the apogee and perigee of the moon, and that they rotate in retrograde. They precess against the natural order of the constellations. So you can see from looking in any ephemeris that in these 3 years, the north lunar node moves from its position in the constellation of the snake tamer, actually, aligned to the galactic center, to a position marked as 210 degrees of the ecliptic, that is to say, at the knees of the Virgin. At the knees of the Virgin, about six or seven degrees beyond the star Kambalia, which marks the absolute limit of the composite of stars corresponding to the figure of the Virgin. What is also important to note is the opposite point. Where does the north node. Where does the south node of the moon stand at this moment, March 2014? Well, it's transiting between the stars in the composite of the ram and the stars in the composite of the fishes. And late in March, in fact, on March 19th onward into April, it aligns precisely with M31, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is located at about 28 or 29 degrees, located in an alignment of 28 or 29 degrees of the ecliptic scale. So here's the picture. I mean, keep this in your imagination. At the beginning of these 3 years, the north node of the moon is aligned to the galactic center. That's a galactic alignment. And at the completion, the south node of the moon is aligned again to a galactic factor, M31, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the closest external galaxy in the entire universe, the twin galaxy to the one we inhabit, and the most distant physical object visible to the naked eye. Now, is that not remarkable? Now, how did I know that all of these unique initial conditions factored into the moment when Sophia, the planetary wisdom goddess, initiated her correction? The answer is, I didn't know. I didn't know. When I intuitively felt and sensed and perceived the event of March 19th, 2011, that was voracious for me. That was absolutely voracious. And you could say that I made an intuitive leap at that moment. Ah, this is the moment she's actually going into correction. This, we are now going to live into the moment that of which the Gnostics and the Telestai spoke. But at the time that I had that intuitive leap, if you will, that eureka moment, I had no idea that the surrounding conditions would be anything like what we're seeing. You can't make this stuff up, folks. You know, none of this was prefabricated. And so it's really, to me, humbling and affirming and delightfully exciting to now be able to stand back and look at the overall conditions of correction and see how, see the fantastically low probability of these conditions falling into the pattern that we now observe. So, having said that, let's proceed to look at the current conditions unfolding at these three points and other navigational factors that are pertinent to our experience right now. Just a little footnote before we proceed to that. I wouldn't want to consider this overview with you without underlining something of paramount importance. Bear in mind that in setting the initial conditions of her correction, the aeon Sophia behaves like an aeon. And in the dynamics of aeonic emanation, by which the myriad worlds of the universe are generated and propagated, the initial conditions are always perfect. The initial conditions that the Aeon Sophia sets in 10 seconds of her time, 36 months of human time, are perfect conditions. And the perfection of that process, the perfection of her pronoia and her enoia, is inconceivable to the human mind, I assure you. It is perfection on an inconceivable scale. Nevertheless, by observing the navigational factors of correction, and by observing the pattern of the celestial code, human animals such as you and I can have an approximative comprehension of what this aeonic perfection is. So contemplate these factors. Get out your rimsight model of the constellations. Actually, it would be great to have a poster size model of the rim site, a poster size model that's large enough to put on the wall. You can stand there right in front of it. You can touch the constellations with your hands. And imagine that you were standing in front of that poster size circular model of the ecliptic zodiac of the 13 observable constellations, with the galactic center point at the top, front and center. The Archer on the left, the Scorpion and the Snake Tamer on the right, and so forth. Imagine standing in front of that and moving your eyes to each of these points of orientation I've just described. That is a way to take into your consciousness the indications provided by the cosmos itself to show the perfection and precision of the initial conditions that she is setting. And it is a matter of awe to stand in the presence of your own awareness of such an event. And I invite you all to do so. Now, gather around the nav. We'll all step forward a little bit closer to the table, the chart table, where I have laid out the drawings and diagrams to plot navigation. There you'll see, for instance, the drawing posted on Gaia Spora of the expanding coil, the induction coil of the pleuromic antenna. That coil is now condensing as Jupiter begins to move forward and to recover its position in exact alignment between Aldebaran and Elnath, corresponding to the first week of September 2011. That's one of the charts. There's a chart of the celestial anchor, and there's a chart you may recall that I drew on 11-11-11 here in Andalusia. That is the chart showing the sequence of 19 perigee hits in the Virgin and the scales. Currently, I'm down in the chart room below. Right now, I'm upstairs in the writing room. But currently, I am down in the chart room below at some point in the day, drafting another illustration, another graphic tool that shows the remaining hits of the perigee until March 2014. What does this picture look like? Well, right now, today, in February 2013, the lunar perigee is located around the forepart of the goldfish. The last perigee moment was February 7th, and at that point, the perigee stood exactly in 10 Capricorn, that's 280 of the ecliptic, and that is in the neck of the goldfish. So the perigee now is in the neck of the goldfish, and remember that at the end of the 3 years of initialization, it is also in the goldfish, but it jumps around erratically, it vacillates wildly, and observing these vacillations that occur in the last year of the 3 years can be extremely instructive. Turn your attention now to the lunar apogee. Well, on February 19th, just about 10 days ago, the lunar apogee stood in 16 degrees of Gemini, that's 76 of the ecliptic. I keep repeating this so you'll learn how to use this jargon. It's not as complicated or forbidding as it sounds. 76 degrees of the ecliptic scale is between the horns of the bull. So right now, the lunar apogee has moved away from the forehead of the bull, where it was stalled, and is actually moving out between the horns of the bull. On March 19th, it will be in 23 Gemini, close to the horn tips, and on April 15th, in 28, that is to say, aligned with the Crab Nebula, which is a celestial object of great interest in astrophysics. And the Crab Nebula is located very close to the southern or lower horn tip of the bull. As you know, in the Sophianic vision narrative, as it's developing with its astronomical content, the Crab Nebula and the star marking Sharatan, the star marking the lower horn of the bull, can be correlated to the Christos, whereas El Nat, the star marking the tip of the upper horn of the bull, can be correlated to Selete. So, finally, we ask, where is the third factor, the lunar node? I have my ephemeris right here, and I can look for, say, March 2013, and there I see that the north node is converging exactly at the fulcrum of the scales. And the south node of the moon, which is exactly opposite, is transiting the ram, and that aligns it to the satanic face of Cetus. Now, how does the navigator read these factors? Well, in the same way that you do, my friends, in the same way that you do. And trust me, with the passage of command, you'll find that the competence you would like to have in these matters, the competence and the confidence, comes on its own to you, and that you don't have to do so much work, actually, to acquire it. Although you do have to prepare yourself to receive that confidence and competence. So, first of all, I'd like to reiterate something I said in a briefing not too long ago. There was a unique perigee hit at the fulcrum of the scales around August 20th, 2012. I proposed that we observe from that moment on how the course of events in the social theater on this planet and in the collective psyche itself might shift, and how the odds might shift to favor those human animals who are good and decent and wish only to coexist with others, against the machinations and insane agendas of the psychopaths. The psychopaths undoubtedly have had an advantage in human affairs for quite some time. But is it possible that the odds could shift against them? And I propose to you now that there is a double omen here. The omen of August 20th, 2012 is followed up by the omen of March and April 2013 with the lunar node touching the fulcrum of the scales. So I would say that the difference between these two moments is that wherever the lunar node comes into play, you're looking at a resurgence of the phylogenetic memory of the human animal. The phylogenetic memory being the transpersonal or collective memory of the entire human species. I think you know by now, although my comments about the lunar node have been somewhat sporadic and not perhaps not consistent, I think you know by now that the lunar nodes signify a memory process of the Aeon Sophia. In fact, they signify the process by which her memory converges with human memory. And whenever that happens, whenever she scans her memory circuits, it's as if there were a spotlight playing over a landscape. And when the spotlight comes to a certain area on that landscape, which up until then is plunged in complete darkness and unseen, not that there's anything wrong with darkness, but it's just unseen, the spotlight illuminates and reveals what is in that part of the landscape. So it's a mixed metaphor here, because I've also compared the precessing rotation of the lunar nodes to a dredging device attached to the mother ship. But we can use more than one metaphor at a time. The metaphor of the spotlight playing over the landscape is, I believe, a helpful one, because you'll understand then that that spotlight is her, represents her memory scanning capacity in our circuits. Try to get that. She can go into the phylogenetic memory banks of any human, of any species, human or otherwise, and scan those circuits. She created those circuits. Imagine, you know, someone who built a computer. The technician who builds a computer, to use an iconic analogy, is able to go in and look at the circuitry that he or she installed in that device. Well, phylogenetic memory is a circuitry that she scans. And as she scans this, whenever her attention comes to a certain area of human experience, bingo, that area becomes released and accessible through human memory. And this has something to do with histones, in case you're wondering. It is a chemical process. It is an effect of her attention, her first attention upon the genetic circuits of the human animal and the shifting of the histones, as it were. So, histone, which are proteins configured into the DNA complex which control the release or suppression of certain packets of information held in DNA. Okay. I would say that the indications of the shift to the advantage of well-intentioned and decent people who simply want to coexist with each other now takes on a new dimension. Suppose, for instance, that all across the planet, human animals in different situations begin to remember what it was really like to live in a society that was fair. That they remember what not justice is, because justice is a social construct, and I don't believe in justice, but that they remember what fairness is. And also, they remember more than anything else the principle of pagan life and pagan civilization at its highest point in its flowering. What is that principle? It's the egalitarian principle. The egalitarian principle is represented, if you will, by the constellation of the balance. That makes sense. The scales. And the egalitarian principle could be stated like this. We are not all created equal. And we are not all of equal talents. Isn't that obvious? But regardless of our differences of capacity and talent, we can all participate in upholding an egalitarian social order that is fair to everyone and that recognizes the differences. So, it's quite possible that with this coincidence of the North Lunar Node at the fulcrum of the scales, that you begin to see people making attempts in the social order, it happens first, of course, in the alternative media, making attempts to recreate out of scratch an entirely new, fair, and equitable, and egalitarian social order. And this is actually happening. Gives you just one example, this character from Australia, Max Egan. Go and read about his current project. Go and read about the One Trust Global Fund, or whatever it's called. Now, I'm not supporting or endorsing any of these projects. What I'm saying is that these projects are spontaneously appearing in the minds of certain human animals, and they are now coming forth out of a kind of memory, out of a kind of memory of how things used to be better, because things did used to be better. I can even remember when things were better in my short lifetime, a hell of a lot better, and a hell of a lot fairer. And so this memory is coming back, and it's arresting the human mind as it comes back in force through the continued progression of these nodes. We may see that it has an arresting effect, something like this. Hey, wait, stop, wait. Let's take a look at what's wrong with this situation. But at the same time, because it's difficult to see what's wrong because of Mephisto rules, because of the deceit and dissembling and treachery of the perpetrators, let's allow our consciousness to recall the simplicity of things when they are right. When things are right, it's simple. When they're wrong, it's very complicated. And so what I propose is that we might consider this action of the lunar nodes as indicating, as it moves through the scales and into the Virgin, and as it moves past the satanic head of Cetus toward the fishes, the north and south nodes respectively, we might consider that this is a kind of return to simplicity and the equitable an egalitarian sense of how life can be run by human animals who are mutually dedicated to peace and coexistence. Correction, how society can be run by human animals who are mutually dedicated to that, or dedicated, as Kropotkin would have said, to mutual aid. Mutual aid is what establishes the right balance of factors in a society where nothing is ever equal. People do not have equal talents. We are not all created equal. Not at all. Far from it. But there is a way to balance the inequalities. And in fact, it's the balancing of the inequalities that generates the beautiful dynamic diversity of a human society. The New World Order, if I may use that horrific metaphor, is a paranoid scenario in which we're all created equal. You know, they all created zombies ruled over by other zombies. That is not a real living society in Gaian terms. Okay, so now let me shift to the lunar perigee and point out some remarkable developments. First of all, as I said, the last perigee moment was February 7th, when the perigee stood in the neck of the goatfish, not exactly in the head and not exactly in the body, but sort of in the neck. As we know, as we have often observed, the lunar perigee sometimes makes violent vacillations and it leaps backward. It leaps backward as much as 30 degrees suddenly, and then it advances forward again. Look at what's happening in the month of March 2013. On March 5th, there's a perigee moment at 270 on the ecliptic. That is directly at the galactic center. There's a perigee hit in the galactic center on March 5th, or if you will, a perigee hit at the stinger. But then, on March 31st, there is a perigee hit at the claw of the scorpion, where it jounces the left pan of the scales. And so, between the 5th of March and the 31st of March, the lunar perigee moves backward 30 degrees through the entire length of the scorpion and the snake tamer. Now, I'd point out to you that on November 14th last year, there was one perigee hit at 29 Scorpio, almost exactly in the same position where it will occur on March 31st. And so that was connected with the LIBOR scandal. Remember that the left pan of the scales has to do with that aspect of finance that is based on currencies and measures of value, whereas the right pan represents commodities. So there has been, since the fall of last year, particularly in November, this tremendous scandal, which is a euphemism for crime, this criminal rigging of the interest rate system that controls the transactions of all the world banks. I don't predict, but I strongly suspect that at the end of March, with this repeat perigee hit in the same position, you could say right on the border between the scales and the scorpion, that we might observe the final shakedown and the final blow to the entire system. Of course, it's something that many experts and mavens in the field have been predicting, such as Max Kaiser and Gerald Celente, the bond apocalypse, the culmination of the currency wars. They call it by different names. In short, a massive global financial quake at the end of March 2013. And then where does the perigee go from there? Well, in the immediate future, you can track it in this way. Late April, it's at the head of the scorpion. And then in May, late May, it's in the lower torso of the scorpion. And then finally it advances again into the archer, and even again into the goatfish, so that in the fall of this year, there is a couple of perigee moments at the head of the goatfish. And this is like looking ahead to the end of correction. And then, of course, there is, due to this reversing motion, this kind of juddering of the lunar perigee, there is one final hit in the scorpion, which is on November 6th. In the lower part of the scorpion near the stinger. After that, the lunar perigee advances permanently into the archer and then into the goatfish, where, as we saw, it resides at the completion of the 3 years of initialization. So as far as the month of March 2013 goes, let's say we're looking at something pretty special and pretty striking here. March 5th, a perigee hit in the stinger of the scorpion, the only one exactly and precisely in the stinger. And then on March 31st, a return to the upper claw of the scorpion. Remember, I described my amazement after having studied the scorpion scales scenario for well on 20, 25 years. My amazement at the change of syntax. Back in Santa Fe years ago in the 80s, I taught people to observe this constellation in its interactivity with the scales by using the syntax. The scorpion upsets the scales. Now I understand, in the perspective of correction, that the scorpion resets the scales. The scorpion resets the scales. So beautiful. It's one of those poetical snippets of astronomical syntax that really sings in the mind. And I would say that I can comment on that right now in this way. How does the scorpion reset the scales? Well, consider this. If things go wrong in the social order due to the operation of psychopaths and archontic zombies, then it's necessary to reestablish the correct order, the workable order of society. Now, no society is perfect, but there is a workable order of society depending on certain principles of fairness, equity, and egalitarian principles, okay? But how can you reset the scales of society, that is to say, the fair dynamic of human interactions on the social level, how can you reset it when there's a bunch of monstrous forces who have taken control of that dynamic? Well, there has to be a deterrent force applied. Can you see the logic of that? Let me give you a silly example. Suppose we get off the mothership and decide to go and visit an island. So we get in a longboat. And there's 20 of us in the longboat. The nav is sitting at the rudder and you're rowing away. And then a couple of people start to get up and they start to violently rock the boat, threatening to overturn the boat. Well, as long as there's a couple of people on the longboat who are violently rocking it, we're not going to be able to get to that island and meet the natives and trade for some coconuts and some jewelry, are we? And what can you do with a couple of mad people in the longboat? You can't stabilize the longboat as long as they're still rocking the boat, so you have to throw them overboard. It's as simple as that. You cannot stabilize society and return to simplicity and sanity in the social order without a deterrent force, a real deterrent force, against those human animals who are disrupting that order. The scorpion is that deterrent force. It is the force of venom. Venom is the deterrent, and it's a lethal venom. And predators, I assure you, predators and psychopaths operating in the highest levels of power and influence on this planet cannot and will not stop what they're doing under any circumstances whatsoever. They will not stop because they cannot stop. And the only thing that can stop them is A, the threat of deterrent force, followed by B, the application of it. That is what I read in the picture described by this marvelous astronomical and poetic syntax. The scorpion resets the scales. It reminds me of the saying about the Colt 45 when it was introduced in the Wild West, a six-shooter. They called it the peacemaker. Does it seem paradoxical that a weapon that's used to kill people should be called the peacemaker? Not to me. Because if you're wearing a Colt 45 on your hip and you walk into a situation in a bar, in a corral, in a hardware store, or out on the range where some crazy psychopathic nuts are upsetting things, you can be sure that the Colt 45 is the peacemaker and that the application of lethal force resets the social order to a peaceful and equitable position. Therefore, it is absolutely inevitable in the course of correction for this issue to come forward, as it is now represented, you know, the insane debate over gun control. It is necessary for this issue to come forward and be resolved in order for human society to fall in alignment with her correction. And there is no other way that can happen. I think the message written in the celestial code in this respect is eminently clear. Now, just to make sure that you don't mistake me on these points, especially those of you who may be listening who don't know where I'm coming from when I speak of violence or elucidated violence, let me do the best I can to see that you don't mistake me, although I can't ultimately decide that, by adding two quick points. The first point is that the human animal has not yet demonstrated that it can use elucidated violence to correct social disorder. It has in some cases. There are many stories of the old Wild West in the United States, perhaps, that illustrate that principle. And you see that celebrated in certain movies, such as the films about Tombstone and the Earp Brothers. And these are moral fables that come out of the United States of America, which, of course, is the frontier land where the very battle of which I speak is going to be decided, and soon. But I want to point out that if you look back in the past, except for singular and remarkable heroic incidents, there is, to my knowledge, no society that has demonstrated so far the comprehension and correct use of elucidated violence as a deterrent force. But if the human species is really divinely designed to excel in violence, as I have stated provocatively, then we damn well better know how to master that capacity. And secondarily, I want to add that I am not in any way against peaceful solutions to recreating society or creating a new society as the old one crumbles. I am not against peaceful solutions, but I am completely against the claim that only peaceful solutions are acceptable. So what I'm proposing, and get really clear on this, is, yeah, let's use as many peaceful solutions as we can. Let's explore as many peaceful channels as we can, but by no means preclude the use of lethal deterrence and elucidated violence where it is necessary. So for me, it is both peaceful actions and the enlightened or elucidated demonstration of violent force, both that brings about the change toward a saner and safer world. Both, not one or the other. So on that point, let me just indicate one more development, and that has to do with Saturn. One more development in the current pattern of events in the navigational view. Let's recall that I proposed that Saturn be metaphorically considered as the light ship in relation to the mothership Earth. Correction for the Aeon Sophia involves, on a planetary scale, that she assumes self-navigation and self-propulsion. These are two completely different things. If you're in an outboard motor and you're cruising up a river or down a river and you come to a bend with some sandbanks, you have to negotiate that passage on the river. To do so, you have to control both the navigation of your outboard craft and the propulsion, that is to say, how much force you apply to the throttle. So, likewise for the mother ship. The Aeon Sophia can use the forces of the planetary system in which the Earth is captured in order to achieve these two processes, in order to achieve or master these two challenges. And how exactly does she do so? Well, I propose to consider this. She uses Jupiter to achieve and maintain her processes of self-propulsion. Remember the metaphor of the tug ship, the tugboat. And she uses Saturn to achieve self-navigation. That is to say, the light ship stands there, it sails along with the mothership, and it is in fact a floating lighthouse. And using the beacon and the beam from the floating lighthouse to assist her orientation, the mothership is able to navigate according to her own parameters and eventually more and more, quite rapidly, to navigate in a manner that is independent of the celestial dynamics of the solar system, but not of the moon and the sun, because the moon and the sun remain part of the total Gaian three-world system. Also, bear in mind that the sun is probably not a body, but more like a vortex, a plasmic vortex. So you can say that the plasmic vortex, represented by the sun, is like an eddy in the river of the galactic arm. If you picture the galactic limb, the third galactic limb where we are located, as a river, the river is coursing, is flowing along, and in the water there are eddies, and the sun is one of these eddies. And the mothership and the other planets of the solar system are not pulled into that eddy, but they are, as it were, navigating along the edges of that eddy. They are within the vortex field of that solar plasmic eddy. So the Earth stays there in its connection with the sun. It uses the moon, as we know, as its steering device. But eventually, with the help of Saturn, in this respect, it frees itself to navigate on its own terms. So look closely at what Saturn is doing here and what it has been doing for some time. First of all, let's go back to December 2012, the first week of December 2012, a memorable moment for some of us. And there, Saturn stood at 8 degrees of Scorpio, which is conjunct the star Cambalia. Now, just 7 days ago, Saturn turned retrograde. It had advanced 5 degrees more. It stood in 13 degrees of Scorpio, which is in the right pan of the scales, and then it turned retrograde. So Saturn right now is turning retrograde. It's in its retrograde station. Consequently, it's going to go back and touch Cambalia again It'll be in mid-May of 2013. It's going to retrograde all the way to 5 degrees of Scorpio, that is to say about 3 degrees from Cambalia. On the 10th of July this year, it turns stationary again, this time reversing its movement to a direct movement. And then finally, it makes the third pass by Cambalia in the first week of September 2013. So, how interesting is that? You might recall that I've said that it is not impossible, but it is quite difficult for the human mind to comprehend what's happening at the moment of the perigee hits. Because what happens in the first attention of the Aeon Sophia is more difficult to understand, according to our minds, than what happens in the second attention, which is her dreaming attention and her memory. The processes of dreaming and memory are more accessible to us, and therefore we can follow the apogee moments with more conscious definition of syntax than the perigee moments. The perigee moments, as you know, are summarized under the phrase divine alchemy. And how interesting is it that during the 3 years of correction, here again, folks, you can't make this stuff up. During the 3 years of correction, the planet Saturn, which has a 28-year cycle, makes a triple pass of the star Cambalia, which represents, of all the stars in the zodiac, the mystery of divine alchemy. So even though you may feel, as I do, that you haven't been able to cognize and conceptualize the perigee hits of divine alchemy as well as you would like to, fear not, fear not. Be patient and keep your minds and hearts open to revelations to come. I am certain that in these ensuing moments of May 2013 and September 2013, as the lightship passes Cambalia, that a deepening understanding of divine alchemy emerges. I don't say it will emerge. I say it emerges at those moments. It can emerge. And so keep that metaphor working in your minds. Saturn is the light ship. And just as the mothership navigates by Saturn in her celestial journey through the galactic limbs, so do we as the human species navigate by Saturn to understand our part in her correction. If you ask yourself, well, I wonder where Saturn stands. I wonder where Saturn's going to be in, say, March or April of 2014 when these 3 years are completed. Well, lo and behold, it is retrograding through 20 degrees of Scorpio, that is to say, at the fulcrum of the scales. So, remarkable events, remarkable developments. This is the timing of the current parameters of navigation. And on that note, I duly complete this nav briefing number 53, which is going forward in 2013.